Chapter 40 The Wedding of Sire Kay and Lady Estret. It had been Alia's idea to schedule Sire Kay's wedding as the opening of the Seven Door Magic Fair, as a means of ensuring attendance by some of the local lords of note. It also cut down on the work, she explained, since the castle had to be cleaned and decorated for each event. By combining the two, the drudges — I had drudges? I had no idea — wouldn't be overtaxed. My wife was at the centre of the mad web of activity. She took the success of the event personally, in a way I didn't quite understand. Everything I said seemed to be the wrong thing to say, and every suggestion I made earned me the nastiest looks. She was visibly upset about every little detail, from how to keep a naturally white castle looking clean to how the banners were hung in the great hall. After the fourth or fifth argument one morning, I made an excuse to get out of the castle. The last thing I wanted to do was fight with my wife after laying waste to domains to rescue her. Penny tried to explain it to me as we toured the Riverfolk's new burrow in my brother-in-law Sagal's holding. "It's the first real social event she is hosting for people outside of Sevendor," she lectured, as we inspected the grand torus of woven sticks and mud that was slowly taking shape on a low rise, overlooking Ketter Stream from the north. For once, she had gone native, abandoning her elegant Remiran gowns for a sensible shift and sideless surcoat, in local Riverland style, better suited for muddy construction sites. She was even wearing boots. But my attention was more on the Talalon than Penny's footwear. I was intrigued by my littlest vassals and how they were getting organized. Under Master Olmeg's guidance and protection, the White Anion and Lob Lolly tribes had merged to form one burrow. I still had a hard time even telling them apart by sight, but Olmeg swears the Lob Lollies are, on average, an inch or so taller, while the White Anion were around 5 pounds heavier. He was very involved in their politics and had negotiated the complicated settlement. Olmeg talked about culturally sub-specialized sub-variants of the species. He knows a fair amount about the Talalon. The White Anions were a more horticulturally oriented and more civilized tribe, in human terms. The Lob Lollies were from a more adventurous and more rustic Wilderlands tribe, one that hunted and trapped more than it farmed. The Lob Lollies, surprisingly, held a 3-pud majority on their little 5-man council. To avoid confusion and promote unity, Olmeg suggested the new burrow take the name Holly Burrow, as the shady banks of the stream grew a fair amount of the spiky evergreen. As the burrow in general treated Master Olmeg with tremendous respect, both sides agreed, and the Holly Burrow it became. Penny seemed oblivious to the politics of the Talalon. She was more concerned with the Riverlands variety. "See it from her perspective. Alia's a newly made noblewoman, and she's undertaken the responsibility of an event no less than the wedding of one of your most important vassals, with lords and ladies of high rank attending. So she feels about how I did when I realized I was responsible for remaking magic for the duchies and suddenly bribing court wizards and dodging assassins," I reasoned. "Only for her, it's a lot worse," Penny agreed, not seeing my humor. "She's not just a lady of a poor country domain. She's a mountain peasant with the stink of cow manure still on her, suddenly being tasked with making a social showing for folk far above her rank. How this wedding turns out will be a reflection of her ability as the Lady of Sevendor. She has much invested in this." "It's just a wedding," I shrugged. "As long as they're married and everyone is drunk at the end, who cares how they get there?" I watched with interest as three riverfolk tried raising a timber to the roof of the structure, struggling to manage a beam no more than 10 feet long, something a man could do one-handed. I gave them a magical assist, hoisting the three a few feet in the air as I levitated the beam into position. The grateful foreman quickly tied it into place while he chewed out his workers in a high, squeaky voice. The fact that the furry little guys were now dressing in cast-off tunics, hose, hats, and other human garb made it even funnier.
"Just a wedding?" Penny gasped, her eyes wide. "Minilan, I cannot believe you just said that. Sir Kay is the closest thing Alia has to a father left, and a wedding isn't just a wedding ever. Or have you forgotten your own?" she asked, an eyebrow raised. I tried to change the subject. Isn't it interesting how the Talalon integrate the drainage system into the channels they use to dilute their waste and use it to grow vegetables?
Yes, the sewage on the roof is lovely, she said sarcastically. Min, you have to understand how important this is to Alia as a woman. Treat it with some respect. She's worked really hard and driven her servants even harder to make this a great event, and that's knowing that she cannot possibly succeed thanks to her origins. But if she doesn't make the attempt, then she sacrifices any hope of respect.
Respect from whom? The people of Sevendor love their lady, I pointed out.
Respect from the other noble women, she said, as if she was explaining the complexities of using a spoon.
Do you not understand what we're talking about? Alia has an entirely new group of peers she must contend with, whether she wants to or not. The other noble women of this region will be looking to her, as the wife and lady of a mage lord, to set certain styles and modes of conduct, customs and expectations, and she has to do it, knowing that they know where she came from. Do you have any idea what kind of challenge that is?
No, I admitted. I had no idea what would impress a bunch of noble women, or why in Trigg's name I'd want to. As soon as the ridgepole for the section was in place, the river folk started laying woven mats of straw over the frame and tying it down with string grass. Then the foreman, a stout towel with a squint, would come along and inspect it before motioning another towel to begin the messy but important job of smearing the mats with a special clay-heavy mud. I watched with fascination as their small, bare hands quickly turned the rough structure into a smooth clay surface.
"She doesn't have a choice," Penny said, irritated. "You've put her in this strange social circle where she doesn't know the rules and given her an impossible job. So this is my fault?" I asked incredulously.
"You're her husband. Of course this is your fault," Penny dismissed.
"The point is, she has to make a good showing at this wedding. Lady Estrit? Estrit is a local noblewoman, albeit a minor one, but she's a vassal to the local baron, who is planning on attending. So is your other chief military ally in the region, and it's the wedding of one of your most trusted vassals. If she doesn't make this the most splendid social event she can, the other noble women will crush her."
"What?
Gossip, you idiot," she fumed. "They will rip her apart in their circles, and if the first demonstration of your skills as a noble woman fall flat, if your hospitality is shallow, or you violate social rules, then you lose position."
"But they can't demote Alia," I pointed out, confused.
"Not rank, position," Penny corrected. "Whole different thing."
"If you say so," I mumbled, as the next towel came around and began pressing a second layer of woven straw mat over the wet clay, using forked twigs to secure it into place. The straw would act like a wick, I could see, helping suck the moisture from the clay to help dry it before the next layer would go on, tomorrow. "I just know this wedding is costing me a fortune."
"It's money well spent,"
dismissed Pentandra. "If Alia can charm these old hens into liking her, then it will be worth double whatever you paid." She squinted at a separate structure, likewise made of wattle and daub, that was taking shape nearby.
"What is that?"
"Their cistern," I explained, glad she'd finally gotten off the subject of the wedding, my wife, and my failures as a husband. "They'll coat the whole thing with clay, then Olmeg or I will magically fire it to cure it. It should hold nearly 200 gallons. They'll erect it on a latticework on the roof, and it can provide water to any part of the burrow." I thought I'd gotten her sufficiently distracted, but I should have known better.
"It's especially important that you be seen as supportive of her efforts," Pentandra continued, unimpressed by plumbing. "If she asks your opinion, give it to her, but leave the final discretion up to her. Don't overrule her unless you can tell she wants you to," she said,
perhaps one of the most confusing pieces of advice she could have given me.
"And in public, you are nothing but sweetness incarnate."
"Hey, we always get along," I protested.
"Well, mostly. We'd had a couple of tense moments, particularly in the first few months of her motherhood, but we'd smoothed them over. Mostly."
"It's not a matter of getting along," she explained patiently.
It's a matter of demonstrating her utterly solid and blissfully happy marriage to a powerful lord. You have to understand, Min. She's going to be under tremendous scrutiny by every woman in the region, from how she conducts herself at a formal event, to how the food turns out, to how she mothers her baby, to how her marriage is run. If she doesn't manage this perfectly, perfectly, then she'll lose position, I supplied helpfully. I still didn't know what the hell that meant.
Exactly,
Pentandra said, pleased by my guess. So be a good little mage, Lord, and let her do what she needs to do to get ready.
Don't worry,
she assured me, after telling me for 20 minutes just how much I should be worried.
I'm helping her, coaching her. So is Lady Estrid, who is quite a dear woman for the rural gentry. She's used to the local hens and knows their peculiarities, which is helpful.
Since I just conquered many of their territories, one would think they'd be inclined toward being charitable, I observed. I could see the next sections of the burrow being laid out by another crew. Due to the size of the combined tribe, the plans to house them were expansive. The central compound, where we were standing, spread out in a slightly imperfect circle to a radius of 90 feet. There was to be a second ring, a specially built outer ring that would eventually be food storage. Then, atop the two, would be built the third ring, mostly individual residential quarters. When they were done, the whole thing would be covered with earth and planted, making it resemble a verdant hill when they were done, a hill with porthole-like windows. The Holly Burrow had more folk than the structure could hold. I knew larger settlements often broke off into smaller pods, or even individual burrows, or human-style houses. Or they might expand the diameter, going for a two-ring design in concentric circles, a real Tal mansion. But instead of increasing the diameter or building a second ring, they were planning two wings to run parallel to the riverbank along the ridge of the rise. The north wing would be devoted to poultry and husbandry, tools and crafting areas. The south wing would be purely residential. Even then, in a generation I could foresee a second ring needing to be built. The river folk were communal at heart. Everyone worked, everyone played, and everyone ate. All the time. But they also smoked, and the river folk's passion for food was almost eclipsed by their passion for good smoke. Olmec had mentioned several exotic varieties he was helping them cultivate for local consumption. They were masterful at herb lore, and then there was their facility with brewing.
Of course they will be. That's part of the problem,
Penny snorted. You just held some of these women as hostage for their husband's or father's surrender. They're going to be ingratiating to the point of being obsequious, but that doesn't mean they won't talk behind her back. Now, if they say anything that gets back to her, they know she has the power to punish. She has social power, even if it's unproven, thanks to your conquest. Sorry I had to inconvenience her social development, I said, as I used mage sight to inspect the way the Tal were tying the layers together. But there was an enemy army besieging my domain.
It couldn't be helped,
she agreed, as if I'd had a choice in the matter. But as it stands, now there's even more pressure. Will this be a gracious conquest, or is she going to be a tyrant?
Why are they worried about her? I'm the one who orders the men with swords around and destroys castles.
It's not the swords they're worried about,
Penny disagreed. They worry about losing their own position. If Alia is suddenly immensely popular, then they will suffer. If she is immensely unpopular, then they will suffer another way. But mostly they worry about losing position in the eyes of each other. So they will try to be part of the consensus opinion of her as it evolves. It really is a difficult situation you've put her in.
I let that pass. It required a full day's argument or none at all. I went with the latter. The river folk had done their best to integrate themselves in their new home in the few weeks they'd been here. My brother-in-law was happy to see them come, although he was confused by their language and complex social rules. After dealing with the sparse, historically lazy peasants who had remained after Ferent's ouster, he was delighted with vassals who would actually work. The district's peasants, no more than a half a dozen families scattered across the holding, actively resented the Tal Alon's presence. One farmer in particular had objected to his new neighbours. He had even gone so far as to beat two of them who had been harvesting rushes in the marshy areas of the district.
He claimed they were trespassing. Sagal disagreed. In the ensuing argument, the man got belligerent and insulting. Sagal was forced to terminate the family's hold and evict them. He turned their lands over to the borough for cultivation and gave the family's hovel to the Talalon headman, Buka, as a temporary residence until the borough was complete. When his other holders saw that, the complaints about the Talalon fell dramatically. The borough had become helpful to the running of all of Sevendor Vale, as it happened. Not only were there now Talalon assistants for Master Olmeg, they wore a copy of his straw hat with a green feather when working on his behalf, but a few dozen had taken work in the castle in preparation for the wedding and fair. While not as strong as humans, they were exceedingly nimble and capable of the most boring of tasks. One of them, Jaffa, had secured a position emptying the castle's chamber pots and cleaning out the privies every day, and had a two-man crew to do just that. Just that morning, I'd noticed that the privies were cleaned and packed with sweet-smelling wildflowers. Another had come to an arrangement with Kay about other maintenance issues at the castle. The old rushes that had been sitting on the floor of the Great Hall for months were carted off by the river folk for some purpose of their own. The same little crew gathered fresh ones in the marshy areas of the holding, adding fall wildflowers and aromatic herbs to them to improve the ambience of the hall. Yet another crew was now in charge of hauling the garbage from the castle and had taken over the refuse pit in the outer bailey. The Tal had been surprisingly helpful in other ways. It was harvest time, and while they were terrible at reaping and threshing, they did an outstanding job of gleaning. You could often see stooped-over Tal females in blindingly colourful skirts following behind human peasants, dutifully picking up any stray ears or sheaves, and their little hands could shuck maize and peas like lightning. And of course, they could cook. In preparation for both the wedding and the fair that would follow, the castle kitchens were swarming with activity, like a hill of angry ants, and there were plenty of river folk involved, and their help was needed. Nanali ran the kitchens and larders of Sevendor Castle with an iron ladle. If anyone felt more pressure than Alia, it was Nanali, who would not see the Lady of Sevendor disappoint in demonstrating our hospitality. To that end, she had imported a dozen additional goodwives from around the Vale, and added as many nimble river folk from the borough to assist as she needed. She didn't particularly like them, but she could not argue with either their industriousness or their love of food. Once she taught them to clean properly, they were happy to scrub away. That was fortunate. The problem with living in an all-white castle is that it shows dirt ridiculously easily, and castles are notoriously dirty, dusty places by nature. The problem was compounded by my vocation. In the home of a mage, mage lights, which we used in abundance, reveal far more than tapers or lamps, and it doesn't take more than a smudge to make an entire wall look dirty. I saw dozens of drudges, both human and Tal, scrubbing every inch of the place with determination and hot water every morning. Beyond the cleaning frenzy, there were a lot of fresh decorations. A dozen new banners with Sevendor's new snowflake device, white on a green field, were hung from the battlements and towers, with a magnificently large one, a gift from Lady Estret and the people of her domain, hung on the chimney in the great hall. The reverse device, a green snowflake on a white field, was displayed as a badge on every guard, castellan's assistant, and other domestic in my service. I felt as if I was being needlessly self-aggrandizing, but Sir Kay sagely pointed out that this was Sevendor's device, not my personal device. I didn't see much distinction. Sevendor's abundant harvest was keeping everyone in the Vale busy, and even with the Tal and the indentured labour from the prisoners of war, there was still the eternal struggle of getting the crops harvested, processed, and properly stored that was every peasant's annual devotion to Huin the Earthborn. Things were especially confusing, because my people didn't know how to properly harvest many of Master Olmeg's new crops. But the flood of coin from my coffers was attracting labour from across the vales of the Riverlands, and my folk were willing to learn. The fruits of their labours were well represented at the wedding. I'd reluctantly presumed on my title to levy a special tribute from each yeomanry for the occasion of Sire Kay's wedding. A common practice, I was assured, and for once I heard nary a grumble about it from my yeomen. Indeed, they seemed to strive to outdo each other in the presentation. Yeoman Karkin of Cowland's Pass arrived 2 days before the wedding with most of his household. As his holding had been occupied and looted during the siege, his tribute was the sparsest. But he managed to bring 20 jars of berry preserves, 3 dozen wild fowl. His 6 young nephews had been practicing with bows since the siege, and several sacks of freshly cut herbs that grew best at that altitude. Yeoman Brandine of Gurisham was proud that his commune could bring 2 entire wains filled with their tribute, and he confessed to me, as it was being unloaded, that he appreciated the opportunity to dispose of some of his surplus. While as hesitant as the Genley villagers to adopt Master Olmeg's ideas about horticulture, the Gurisham commune was now an enthusiastic supporter of his efforts, and their granary was full to bursting as a result. 6 bushels of potatoes, 10 of maize, 4 of carrots, and 4 of beans enriched our pantry, while 4 crates of Gurisham chickens went to the butchery behind the kitchens. Yeoman Guris of Southridge was generous to the point of embarrassment. The Bovali had taken charge of the holding only that winter, but the native Sevendori peasants had prospered under his leadership, as I suspected they would. 3 full wagons of everything from smoked hams to casks of pickled eggs to crates of turnips were unloaded. Guris himself dressed as richly as a lord, and his folk arrived in new finery, bragging of their prosperity. While my brother-in-law Sagal's hold brought in a small but respectable tribute of 20 hens and 7 dressed goats, his biggest contribution was the small parcel he reverently laid in my hands as his wife Ella greeted her sister, and my nephew Sagellan and my son contended for the title of crankiest baby in the castle. I think little Sag had Min beat by a hair. "Bovale cheese," he said smugly as I unwrapped the white muslin. "Oh, not the actual Bovali, of course," he assured me, "but as close as I could come here. I suppose it's Sevendori cheese now. Cow's milk and with goat's milk, prepared in the traditional way. It's still a bit green, but you can see where it's going. Try it," he encouraged eagerly. I did, carving a piece off with my belt knife. After spending a year in Beauval Vale and marrying into a proud cheese-producing family, I'd learned a little about how proper Bovali was supposed to taste. This was close. A little more tart on the tongue. Rich, salty flavour. Good aftertaste. Not perfect, but very close. And I said so. "Just wait until it's aged a year," he nodded excitedly. "A year in the cold and this will be first rate. A little softer than Bovali, but still," he said happily. I cut a piece off for Alia, who made the most embarrassing noises about it. Yeoman Vanno, who had spent most of the year leading the stubborn peasantry of Brestol village, was nearly as generous with the wedding tribute as Sir Gal. Sir Kay had been extremely supportive of his efforts to coax the Brestali into prosperity, and a full cart of the first fruits of their first harvest was token to that effort. But no one outdid Yeoman Rollo, the headman of the village now known as Beauval Hall. When his manor gave to their castellan's wedding, they did so with unrestrained pride. The Bovali who had built it from the ground up were the heart and soul of the old Vale, from Zagor the hedgemage, still settling into his big new shop, to Arstol, the saddle maker running his, the new Beauval Inn, being run by Mother Breda, the Loud, and her sons. Even had a Wilderland-style luck tree outside of the inn. That was a custom from the Mindons unknown in the Riverlands, so it gave a little folksy charm to the newly hewn village. The shrine to Huin was well-tended and popular, and land brother Tevrim had successfully concluded the harvest rites for the Vale, which Huin had so abundantly blessed. They were proud of their castellan and eager to contribute. Bushel after bushel of maize, wheat and oats arrived at the castle in Bovali carts, as well as more potatoes, leeks, pumpkins and salted pork. Considering how involved he had been with its inception, Beauval Hall considered Sire Kay to be one of their own, and they wanted to show him their appreciation. Far from jealous of the knight's place in his yeomanry, Yeoman Rollo seemed the most eager to boast of the relationship. Lastly, Yeoman Cayman of Westwood arrived on foot with a good 2 score of his folk, the most the Westwood had sent to Sevendor in living memory. The woodmen were not stingy in their tribute, bringing 4 butchered stags and 9 boars, as well as dozens of smaller beasts and birds, and 4 bushels of nuts from the wood. Young Kaya looked inordinately pleased with himself as he presented a handsome winter bearskin cloak with a silver snowflake clasp. All right, it did look kind of like a spiderweb to Sir Kay as a wedding gift. Apparently the lad had slain the bear himself. Sir Kay was well respected by the reclusive folk, and that respect was returned. It seems the Westwood men had been eager scouts in Cowland's Pass, as well as adept at sniping at the Westflarians during the siege. Their boldness and dedication had endeared them to Sir Kay, who found them to be competent and brave in war, even for commoners. They had even consented to be led by Sir Festeran for a sortie. Indeed, that had been the event that had provoked Kaya's gift. During one assault down the pass, after Raylan's treachery had seen the holding occupied, the road into the Vale had been guarded by the Western Yeomanries while they awaited reinforcements from Southridge. The more timid folk of Cowland's Pass had fallen back quickly when the Flareans had tried to descend in force, leaving the Westwood men pinned in a precarious place, brave Sir Festeran commanding them from a rocky outcropping. Sir Kay had been inspecting the area at the time, and had rounded up a dozen armed men and led a counterattack sufficient to let the Westwood men escape through the forest. Kaer of Westwood, who had led his people in battle, felt obliged and grateful to Sir Kay, hence the beautiful bearskin, and it was but one of many magnificent gifts the folk of the Vale gave to him personally. Sire Kay felt embarrassed about being the focus of so much attention, but both Alia and I insisted he accept them all graciously. Not that he would have done it any other way. "You're a hero to the Bovali," my wife told him when he expressed discomfort about the largesse. "For obvious reasons, and the native Sevendori respect you and even love you a little after your triumph in the tournament and your defense of the domain. If you don't give them a chance to show their respect, it would be insulting to them," she reasoned. "I do not wed my lady in hopes of material gain," he said, immediately recognizing the irony of the dowry she brought to the marriage. "Nor do I want the common folk to beggar themselves in an effort to gain my favor. I'll relax and enjoy the glory you've earned. I've had to deal with adoration far beyond my worth for months now," I kidded the knight as we watched one wagon of tribute after another arrive before the wedding. "It's time you enjoy some. You did an ideal job at defending the country. Give these folks a chance to show their appreciation." "I only did what I swore to do," he said uncomfortably. "You never swore to lead these folk leagues across the land, into danger and out again, into a new land and against a new foe. But you did. The Bovali are grateful. The Sevendori are respectful. And the new territories we just conquered are lining up to kiss your ass, since you will be ministering over them. Enjoy it," I commanded him. Lady Estrut, at least, was more comfortable in her role. This was her second wedding, after all, and as enamored of Sir Kay as she clearly was, she was also practical enough to recognize a golden opportunity for good relations with the common people. She helped steer her awkward mountain knight through the process of receiving gratitude graciously, something that did not come naturally to Sir Kay. For the wedding ceremony itself, since Sevendor lacked a proper temple as yet, and the shrine to Huin was considered both too remote and too small to accommodate the crowd, I had a lovely temporary chapel built of mage-wrought wood in the inner bailey of the castle, on a base of snowstone, 20 feet wide, open to the air. It was a place where the priestess could conduct the ceremony and later could be used for other social purposes. I put Rondel and the newest war mage candidate, a pleasant middle-aged veteran named Busselin, on the job, and of course Pentandra insisted on overseeing it. She let the Magi indulge themselves in decorating it with her direction. Not only did it end up festooned with flowers by the morning of the wedding, it glowed with tiny mage lights and floating sparkles, and bells of glass and silver tinkled in the breeze from its eaves. Our noble guests began to arrive the day before the wedding, with Sire Sigalan and his retinue early in the morning, and Baron Arathaniel's smaller but no less prestigious company passing the dyke tower at twilight, their pavilions already pitched in the inner bailey by servants sent in advance. Lesser nobles had arrived earlier, particularly my new subject vassals. That was by my request, as I'd wanted time to get to know the men who would be swearing fealty to me at a court held after the wedding. Sir Kay invited me to stand vigil with him that night, a special honor I could not decline. We spent the time in the chapel in front of the gods, discussing the finer points of marriage. Although I was new to the art, I had been earnestly collecting lore on the matter for a while, and had some wisdom to impart to Kay on the subject over the best bottle of wine I could procure. Whether or not it was helpful or hurtful, I suppose I'll never know, but he was passing nervous as dawn approached. I left him to his ritual bath after morning prayers by the yawning bride sister and grabbed the much-needed nap in the hammock in my lab. I was awoken by my valet in plenty of time to dress and prepare for the rite. The afternoon ceremony was lovely. Estret looked beautiful in her white gown, the arms of her little land embroidered on her shawl, her train carried by her adorable little girl, who was wearing a matching gown. The harpists I'd hired played a pretty hymn to Trigg as she came from the east side of the chapel, while Sir Kay arrived from the west. The priestesses purified them both, blessed them, asked them the questions about their rights and freedoms and duties and obligations, then prayerfully bound them together in matrimony. Faresa acted as flower girl and temporary assistant acolyte, and she couldn't have looked happier. I've never seen Sir Kay look happier, and Lady Estret looked enchanted at her big mountain night. After the ceremony proper was the second part of the affair, where Sir Kay of Sevendor became Sire Kay of Car Gwenyon, as he took the oath of fealty from Baron Arathaniel. That bound our domains closer together, now that we shared a vassal. While that was much less important now than it had been a few months ago, it still did my heart good to hear. Then we held what was perhaps the most generous celebration in Sevendori history. The feast at the castle was magnificent. The high table hosted the bride and groom, myself and my lady, and the greater nobles and members of the clergy. Around it was arrayed a circle of trestle tables where important guests, nobles from other domains, knights, yeomen and their families, and prominent merchants from the village were seated. Beyond that, the tables got less formal and the titles and manners began to decline in rough proportion. The freemen and the villeins of the Vale alike had been invited, in part to celebrate the harvest and their castellan's wedding. Out in the bailey, hundreds camped on blankets and cloaks or brought their own trestles to eat upon. Meat and bread were consumed in abundance, and ale and cider flowed freely, and no one was turned away. As for Sire Kay and Estret, they both looked like Trigg and Ishi had come down in person and blessed them both with love and happiness. Alia and I couldn't have looked that sweet at our own wedding. They ate from the same plate, drank from the same cup, and shared a dance, and all of the other silly traditions people do to reaffirm love and life and such. At twilight, we sent off the happy couple in an enclosed carriage that was to take them to a remote holding near the spring in Brestall, deep in the wood there, where a cottage had been prepared for their maiden moon. During the interminable round of drinks, blessings and bawdy talk that seemed required for such an event, I drunkenly insisted that I didn't want to see either of them for 3 days, and that I fully expected to hear their screams of passion across the valley. That made Sire Kay look away uncomfortably, Estret blush, and my wife give me holy hell a few moments later when we were alone. But it was well worth it. Even Penny thought so. As the carriage rolled away, Sire Kay's new charger trotting behind, the Magi attending made a point of filling the air with brilliant effects and colourful fireworks. The colours reflecting on the white castle and white mountain behind it were only outdone by the colours of the autumn sunset. I retired back to the great hall with my arm around my drunk, exhausted, and extremely pleased with herself wife, and nearly tripped over Bannermore on the way in. Bannermore had been present at the ceremony, of course. As spell warden, his position required him to be, just as Master Olmeg had been obliged to attend, but he begrudged every moment spent celebrating as graciously as he could, and returned to the commons and his headquarters as soon as he could. Already more than 2 dozen vendors had encamped on the commons, and more arrived at the dyke tower every hour, he told me quietly. The wedding was nice, but he had work to do. As weddings go, it was splendid, and impressed the gentry of the Bontal Vales immensely. There were even songs written about it. It was far grander than my own, but I didn't begrudge a penny I'd spent on it, and it was a wonderful way to begin Sevendor's inaugural magic fair.